Sure, why don't you tell a little bit about where you come from and how you came to be where you are?
Okay, so I should say, unlike most talks, when I'm going to give a talk, I plan, I prepare. I'm totally unprepared here, so this is all off the cuff. I'm from Colorado. My family's Colombian, but moved to the States when I was young. Went to high school there, went to college at MIT, then went to Harvard for grad school, and did a postdoc, moved over to the Western US, and then came up to PI. So this is my first place in Canada. I've been here for about 3 years now, getting on to 3 years. And throughout that time, I sort of dabbled back and forth between theory and experiment, mostly doing theory as a grad student, and then towards late in grad school, getting interested in really how do you connect the theoretical questions to experiments, not just in principle, but how do you really make contact? If we were to see some physics beyond the standard model, say, at the Large Hadron Collider, right now we've just discovered the experimentalists at the LHC have just discovered the Higgs boson, which is great, super exciting, but it's a confirmation of theory that had been sort of speculated about and calculated about for many decades now. If you were to see something, something much more intricate and surprising, how would you map that data onto thinking about the theory and what it actually means? That was sort of the first thing that got me in close to experiment as a late grad student. And I actually spent some time working closely with experimental groups over at CERN on groups working on the LHC analyses, sort of refining ideas of how to actually make that bridge, that gap from the experimental data, which is like particle went there, a different kind of particle went there in the detector. All particles we know about, just using basically the shape information of those collisions, how do you get from that, those shapes, to, well, these are the new kinds of states and symmetries that we think there are in nature. How do you bridge that gap? And then after that, went back to what I thought was doing more theory at Stanford. And instead, the thing that really piqued my interest there was looking for new forces. And that turned out to be, so in particular, I mean, there's searches for new forces at the LHC for very, very sort of comparably strong forces to the ones we know about, but just forces that operate at very, very short distances. That's the kind of physics that the LHC looks for. There's searches for new forces at extremely long distances, which have to be very weak forces, weaker even than gravity. But what I got interested in, and this is another thing that both of these are things that I've worked closely with Philip on, was looking for forces that operate at sort of medium distances. And medium to a particle physicist, or large to a particle physicist, is small to an everyday human. Because it's like distances comparable to the size of an atomic nucleus, the size of a proton, or maybe a couple hundred protons lined up in a bunch. That's sort of long-range force as far as particle physicists are concerned. And thinking about how to look for those took us to Jefferson Lab, which is a smaller compared to, say, CERN, mainly nuclear physics lab in the US. And we actually worked with somebody from Jefferson Lab very closely, and then with a larger collaboration later, to put on a small-scale experiment to look for these new forces. And so we did what's called a test run early on, and a fuller version of the experiment is now underway. Not running right now, but we are working with the lab to get it on the schedule and to get it running in the next couple of years. And then since then, I guess we've both turned towards spending a large fraction of our time on much more theoretical formal things where we hope to make contact with experiment in the near future, but we don't entirely know how yet. But maybe that will, so I'm sure either of us would be happy to talk about that later, but I've probably blabbered on long enough now and should open up to questions about whatever you guys are interested in.
I was wondering, in a regular day of work, I mean, what is it that you're doing most of the time? As a
Well, let's see. So actually, so should we go? Well, are we supposed to go straight into questions, or should we just sort of finish rounding out the? Because that's a great question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can wait, of course.
So I wanted to actually ask all of you a couple of questions before. Sorry, I'm just going to be forward about this. So yeah, actually, how old are most of you? Are you like, is this like senior in high school, junior in high school?
Yes.
And I mean, and where's everybody from? Like, what fraction are you from a major ocean away, or from North America or South America?
Show of hands, guys. How many Canadians?
Yeah.
A lot of Canadians.
How many Americans? How many Europeans? How many Asian? How many Africans? Anybody from the Antarctic? I think that's
it.
Yeah,
that's
great.
We
have no South America this year, I don't think. Do we? Do we have Central?
Mexico.
And can I also ask, I mean, so how many people here know that they want to go into a science like physics or chemistry or yeah, so pretty much everybody here is. Okay. Because now is a really it's a great and very unusual time to be going into especially basic physics. So Natalia already sort of kind of alluded to this earlier. So I mean, we sort of got started in physics probably, what I mean, it's order 10 years ago. About 10 years ago. So when we got started in physics, you know, sort of at the undergraduate level, going into graduate school, the thing that was on the horizon back then, I mean, so sort of just to set the stage, was there was already lots of evidence that most of the matter in the universe is something that we don't know about. Presumably it's some kind of particle. But there was a basic, simple idea that people have had for decades, that the dark matter is just a simple particle that behaves like other particles that carry weak interactions, like neutrinos, but heavier, okay? And the assumption was that'll just pop out the next time we build a big collider and start running it. And that big collider that everybody was talking about when we were going into physics is the LHC. The LHC's been running for a while. At the same time, it was, well, the LHC is going to finally tell us how certain basic symmetries of nature are broken and resolve some really long-standing puzzles about nature and the process. So when we went in, it was like there's this slew of ideas that had been worked out for 30 years, very long time, worked out in excruciating detail, lots of different scenarios mapped out, and it was just like, just on the horizon, everything would be settled, we would get our answers to our questions, everything would fall into place, and we could move on, and we could talk about kind of the next stage. So that was very exciting in its own way. I mean, there was sort of a sense of like, well, you know, let's hope it doesn't all just fit into place too quickly, because then what will be left to do? I mean, that was kind of one concern. But so then what started to happen is the LHC turned on, and there was a very big success very early on, where one piece of kind of the puzzle did fit into place, and we discovered the Higgs over the last couple of years. And that was a big, big deal. I mean, that was verification of like 60 years of serious theoretical work, and it sort of gave us confidence that we were roughly on the right track. But at the same time, there were a bunch of things that were confusing that we ran into. We didn't find, so far, a lot of the things we thought we would find, which has caused a great deal of consternation and confusion in the physics community, okay? There's you know, people, there's a variety of reactions to this. But I would characterize the sort of current state of affairs as kind of a what the heck moment going on. Okay, at the same time,
there's a little bit of indignation with nature.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of indignation as well. You know, I mean, it just 30 years of just basic speculation is just being tossed out the door. Okay, people's careers are just being chucked out the window because everything they thought about looks more or less now irrelevant to the way nature works.
Are you referring to supersymmetry?
No.
Anything in particular?
I'll come back to that.
Okay.
There's no sweeping statements like supersymmetry is dead or this is dead. It's a little more. It's just, you know, there's qualifiers, and there's qualifiers that are important because the LHC is still running, and the LHC is going to increase its energy, and there's going to be another shot at trying to get answers to these questions. So that's still, you know, the verdict is out. But the other thing that's happening is we've been looking for dark matter. And it's looking increasingly like it's unclear if dark matter interacts with us directly or if it just interacts with us through gravity. We still don't know what it is. And so now I would say, instead of having, you know, this kind of basic picture that we had that it's something simple, it's just like a neutrino, but heavier, I think that idea is being challenged. And now a lot of people in the physics world are wondering, well, maybe it's a little more complicated. Maybe it didn't work. It's not working the way that we thought. And now the real challenge, one of the really big challenges, is to find ways to do new experiments to figure out what dark matter is. I mean, it's just basic science, okay? Just what experiments do you do to figure out what dark matter is? So now we're in this situation where we're kind of like in the middle of getting all this information from dark matter experiments, some of which you saw at Snow Lab. I think there was a trip to go to Snow Lab. So those experiments are actually really important over the next few years, okay? Because they're looking in places that nobody's been able to look, because they're so deep underground, they're very sensitive. So we're going to learn a lot from those very soon. But we're trying to also find new experiments to look for dark matter, to look for things that might be related to dark matter. And this is really kind of one of the big problems of the field right now. So this is something, I mean, is what you were saying. This is something that both of us work on. But instead of having this picture where it's like, we know what's going on, let's just go find it, it's more like trying to sort of brainstorm and just think more broadly about what could it be, what kinds of experiments do you do. And that's a driving factor for me and for Natalia in sort of deciding how we spend our time. Okay, so that's part of the reason we've been doing experiments. That's how we decide sort of what we think about. When we come into work, it's actually one of the leading things that we think about every day. We sit down and we're like, okay, you know, we may have a few ideas for experiments to do, and then we work very concretely on thinking about how to develop those experiments. Okay, so just that's not quite answering your question in the detail you want, but so right now is a really, really, you know, strange and exciting time for physics, because there's a very palpable sense that we are missing something very basic about the way that nature works at a lot of different levels, with dark matter, with weak interactions, potentially things that may tie into cosmology or tie into gravity at very high scales. And there's sort of a lot of people stepping back and just asking themselves, what the heck did everybody miss? Okay. So it's, you know, so keep that in mind. So when you come in, that's kind of the atmosphere that you're going to be entering into to some extent when you walk into physics. And I think that's a great thing. To some extent, you know, we can't relate because it was very different when we came in. But you know, I'm almost envious that you're coming in at that stage. So. So you were asking, what do we do on a day-to-day basis? So right on a day-to-day basis, we typically have several very specific projects that we're working on. So some projects are harder than others. So sometimes you come in and you work on something where you more or less know what to do, and it's, you know, it's a question of doing calculations that you know how to do, but you got to do them. You got to see what the results are. You talk to your collaborators. It's very collaborative. So we have one project where we're working, where the two of us are working on it together. It's actually a project thinking about new experiments to look for dark matter. We have a couple of postdocs here at the Institute we're working with, and we spend a lot of time talking, a lot of time doing calculations, and it progresses, you know, smoothly, and it's a lot of fun. And then there's other projects that we have that are more speculative, where the questions we're asking don't have a well-defined theoretical framework to sort of. You can't just sit down and calculate something with well-defined rules because you don't have a well-defined theory to work with. You're building a theory. That's sort of one of the projects we're working on. That tends to be more of a day-to-day struggle. And there you sometimes get stuck. And in fact, you really have to learn how to be stuck a good fraction of the time without getting discouraged. And so, you know, that's probably something we'll come back to. Should I let you answer that question as well?
Sure, yeah, so maybe I can just add a few things. So those are two types of, as Philip was saying, exactly what we do day to day depends on what kinds of projects we're working on. So in sort of other directions, sometimes we and other people at PI do very computational projects where we're really writing code, analyzing data, doing a lot of simulations and trying to sort of to process that information. So that's, you know, obviously a lot of computer time, and then a lot of time trying to understand in the simplest way possible what's coming out of the computer as a way of sanity checking that you're not making mistakes. And trying to really extract from all the computational work what are the sort of big picture lessons that you learn from all the numerical stuff. Another thing that we do pretty often that's a lot of fun. So we have visitors usually once every week during the sort of September to May part of the year, or once every 2 weeks. Visitors coming in from around the world, around the country, around the U.S., telling us about what research they're thinking about. Sort of, it's very interactive. It's really a big global community. And so it's a nice opportunity to really learn what other people are thinking about and interact and exchange ideas with them. And then, I mean, we do spend some amount of time teaching and mentoring grad students, which are totally different experiences, teaching in a blackboard versus really working with a student on usually a research project that's helping them at the same time to sort of get up to the speed of a researcher in the field. And a fair amount of writing, too. Yeah, Holly.
When you are our age, like, I know it's different for everybody, but like, I'm approaching my last year of high school now. What were you doing when you were my age to get to where you are? Like, I'm trying to read stuff and get interested in it, but how did you get to where you are? You know, what did you do proactively to get where you are now?
So I did, I guess, around high school, I did a few sort of summer programs of different kinds, you know, some a lot like this, some more research-oriented when I could. So, you know, not a lot, because there's only so many years to do that. I did a little bit of reading, but honestly not that much, because for the kind of physics that I'm interested in, it was like, you know, you really need background to actually understand what people are talking about. So I spent a lot of time just trying to learn, you know, trying to learn some college physics in advance, trying to learn more math, just learning foundational stuff. And I think it was only really around the time that I was getting into grad school that, like, even when I was applying to grad schools, I did not have a clear idea at all of what particle physics research was, or what state of the art was, or what supersymmetry was. I had taken one field theory class, which is unusual for it's not part of the standard undergraduate physics degree, but still wasn't up at the sort of, you know, I couldn't look at a paper on particle physics and understand what it was about, even at that point. It was really like my first year of grad school that I got to that point. So I just want to mention that as a sort of assurance, because it can be really intimidating to look at the research papers and be like, how am I ever going to get there? But, you know, but you do. I think learning basics well and really taking the time to understand stuff like quantum mechanics when you get to it, all the mathematics that you use, is very important. And then just spend it, especially if you want to go into theory. And just trying to get your hands dirty in whatever the techniques are going to be. So if you're more interested in experimental physics, trying to get some research experience at the university, I think, is really useful. If you're just in theoretical physics, then I would actually prioritize, I think, you know, a little bit of sort of research or independent reading projects are really good, but the main thing is also really learning foundation as well. That's still a little bit ahead. I know you're asking about like right now. At least for something like particle physics, I'd say at the sort of late high school, early university level, I think the main priority should be sort of learning the foundations. And then also, you know, read some popular science, get an idea of, and things like, you know, the science magazines. A lot of what they say is overhyped. Things I shouldn't say on a recording, in the science magazines. You shouldn't take it all as fact, but it will sort of help you build an idea, I think, of what kinds of questions do you find intrinsically captivating? Because when you get into you know, further on and thinking about what kind of research projects you want to do in college, it helps to know what kind of questions you find captivating. There's a lot of things that even if you love science, you just won't care about that particular problem. And it's really hard to work hard on something you don't care about. So sort of get a sense of where your own interests lie that way.
Anything to add?
An anecdote. So, I mean, when I was in high school, I do very distinctly remember. So I went to school in a small town, and we didn't have much in the way of physics. We did have a very good chemistry course in the high school. But so I didn't even know that I wanted to do physics until relatively late. The only thing that kind of vaguely got me interested in physics was Hawking's Brief History of Time book. It was a popular science book. I'm not sure how I feel about that book now. I think it's still very good, but at the time, it was just totally eye-opening. I don't think I even realized that physics, the way that people do it in this building, is even something that you could do as a living. It just was just not on my horizon. So I remember I did go to the bookstores in. I grew up in Oregon City, Oregon, and I would go to bookstores and I would look at. I mean, you know, like a lot of bookstores, whatever around here, it's Chapters. They'll have one or two books on quantum mechanics or a couple, some books on some advanced topics. And I'd pull it off the shelf and I'd open it up and it'd be just like thick layers of equations. And I'd look at this and it's, I'm never going to understand this. This is crazy. I've got to work really hard. So I kind of got a sense that I didn't know very much. So I mainly studied math. So if I had to make one recommendation coming out of high school, I'll make two. First of all, figure out what you are interested in. Don't just look at what everybody else is interested in. I mean, I know it's kind of obvious, but that's kind of probably the most important thing. The second thing is really focus on the basics. And I think the basics, among the very basics for physics, for chemistry, a lot of subjects, is make sure you learn just basic mathematics. This was sort of a hang up with me for a while, and I ended up starting out studying mathematics as an undergrad. I wasn't going to be a mathematician. I knew I wasn't going to be a mathematician. I wasn't cut out for it. But it made it a little bit easier later on. And math can be difficult, and it is difficult, but it's one of those things where you just keep working at it, and you acquire a little bit of more familiarity with it, and it makes everything else a lot easier in the physical sciences. Okay, so that's just one thing. So just sort of be vaguely aware of that. But that's probably even too much of a sweeping generality, because there's a lot of different things that you may end up going into. There's all kinds of different physics. And so that last piece of advice is very specific to theoretical physics. So don't worry about it if that's not your cup of tea. Yeah.
Well, let's see. Should we go back? I think, yeah.
How difficult is it to get a job working in physics? Because I remember I went and I told a friend of the family that I had been accepted to an astrophysics degree. They said, oh, cool, I know a guy who got an astrophysics degree. He sells real estate in Calgary now. Well, that kind of freaked me out.
The truth is that if it's not easy to get the odds. Well, look, I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat it. The odds are against you at some level going into it. I think if it's like with most things. If you're good at what you do, it's usually apparent very, not super early on, but it's usually apparent at some point. It becomes clear to you and it becomes clear to the people around you that you're pretty good at what you do. And then you'll be fine, okay? And if it's not working out, usually you sort of figure that out as an undergraduate or even in graduate school, okay? You can actually get pretty far along and you can sort of decide, look, it's not for you, and you can switch fields. And so usually I would think it kind of works out. But at the end of the day, no, it's not so easy to get a permanent position in theoretical astrophysics or theoretical physics. It's not just skill. I mean, it's skill. It's also equal amounts of luck. Nobody talks about the luck, but there's a heck of a lot of luck involved. Having an advisor that picks good projects for you, having sense yourself to pick good projects that are sort of timed in an opportune way. Those, you can sometimes say, well, that's skill, but no, there's luck in that too. Okay. But I think if you're really interested in this subject, and you feel like you've got even a little bit of talent for it, you should go for it. I mean, you should, but definitely don't do it unless you feel really impassioned to do it. Okay. It's the sort of thing where you should just dive in head first and then look back much later. Don't constantly look over your shoulder.
Yes, I think you can do the math, right? On average, each professor has maybe two students or three students at a time. They each graduate in 4 years or 5 years, and the number of professors in physics isn't growing, right? And they have a sort of term ranging from sometime in their 30s to, you know, late 60s, during which they produce many more students than are needed to replace themselves. So it's a competitive market, for sure. That said, so a couple of things. I think what Philip said is right. If you're passionate about it, do it, and you feel like you're doing, you know, reasonably well, even though sometimes you don't feel like, even no matter how good you are, sometimes you feel like you're doing terribly. Have a go at it if it's really what you want to do. And if things don't work out, there are a lot of career paths open to you where having technical background, something like a graduate degree in physics or in any other science, can be really helpful. It's not like the career that's training you for, but you do get a lot of useful background out of it. I'll just say one thing that's not that politically correct. Try to get into a good grad school, by which I mean prestigious. It's just a fact that although I know plenty of people that are tenured that went to, you know, good but not sort of uber prestigious grad schools, I know about the same number of senior people who went to sort of good grad schools as the number of senior people I know who went to like Harvard, Princeton, etc. It's a lot easier to get a job if you happen to get into a good grad school and into a sort of top prestigious grad school. It's just because it's a lot easier to get noticed for the creative work you do if people have already sort of associated you with a prominent, really prominent person. If you don't go to Harvard or Princeton, and I'm talking about the U.S. schools just because that's the community that I sort of came of age in as a physicist, then, if you do really creative work and really interesting work, you're still going to get noticed. But I think the bar is a little higher. So that's just a sort of, unfortunate fact of any kind of professional network that there is. And it's a ways away for you guys, so relax about it.
Yeah, I mean, that I just want to iterate that second point. That's really far away at this point, okay? The main thing to focus on is just, college, university,
right,
figuring out what you want to do, learning the basics. And, if you're lucky and if you work hard and if you've got skill, the grad school part of this will work out because people may notice you early on. Okay, so but that last part is sort of statistically true, but there's a certain cause and effect issue. It's some of it's sort of a selection effect. Okay, Kayla.
Does undergrad matter as much? Like where you go for undergrad?
No. Sorry. I mean, let me correct that. So it matters a heck of a lot less than graduate school. Okay, it matters significantly less. So just professionally looking around at people who have permanent positions, who do theoretical physics or other types of physical sciences for a living, they come from all over the world, all over the place, as far as undergraduate background is concerned, okay? I think at some level, part of the reason for this, Natalia alluded to, graduate school is the first place where professionally people start to take very precise notice of who you are in your sort of professional identity, okay? But as an undergrad, you're just learning basic things, you're still figuring out what you want to do, and there's many ways of doing well that don't require that there's some sort of like network that the place is tied into. So people come from all over the place, okay?
Yeah, so all I was getting at with the graduate school thing is, do take your sort of your work and thinking about what you want to do seriously. Very seriously as an undergraduate, because that'll help you, get wherever you want to go, as well as help you figure out whether grad school is even what you want to do. Yeah, Daniel, you had a question?
Yeah, my question is it like if you go to a school that's not maybe as prestigious as Harvard or whatever, is it easier or is it more difficult to get into a good grad school, or is that completely irrelevant?
I don't think I know that as well. I don't think it's like, it's probably not completely irrelevant. That's a strong word, right? But as Philip was saying, I think it matters a lot less. I think I know tons of people from my own grad school time, who went to good but smaller, less prestigious schools as undergraduates, made a strong impression on their professors. In many cases, much stronger impressions than the Harvard students, because they didn't have the sort of 200-person anonymous classes, or just because they really stood out from the crowd for how engaged they were at larger schools. So I knew a very, I'd say, a pretty diverse set of people in terms of their undergraduate background as a grad student, and many of them did very well.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can't talk in detail about how the process works, but I mean, I've been on an admissions committee for PSY, so has Natalia. And I know that a lot of physics graduate admissions work very similarly elsewhere. People are not looking at where you came from. They're looking at the quality of the applicant. They're looking at what you did, how well you took advantage of your opportunities, kind of how hard you worked, kind of what people sort of thought of you, whether you made an impression on people. They don't really, I mean, you could be from any of a number of different schools. And it's sort of the name matters, just doesn't matter that much. Very quickly, I'm just speaking personally, and I think Natalia can reflect this. Really, people look at sort of what you did. And that actually does matter a lot more than where you came from at the undergraduate level, for sure. So there was, I think you had, yeah. So I'm trying to keep it.
I have a question. Could you change the direction of research? For example, now you do particle physics and you say, oh, quantum gravity, that's interesting. Do people do that sometimes, and how hard would it be?
Well, sorry, are you asking about sort of changing kind of what you're doing from say,
in a totally completely different
than particle physics, quantum gravity,
in a different direction?
People do it. Some people do completely change. There's two stages typically where people completely change their research path. One is very early in graduate school. The other common stage is late in somebody's career. These are sort of two places where research directions will often totally change.
Wait, what you mean is sort of
after they're tenured.
After they've gotten a faculty job,
yeah.
Maybe after the tenure.
Yeah. But typically for people late in their graduate phase or, you know, early out of graduate school, they're usually really focused on, you know, what they've got expertise in, and they're really trying to make contributions in the area that they trained, and they won't usually change at that point. It's not. Now, a lot of people actually learn quite a bit about more than one field. They'll have some expertise, say, in quantum information and particle physics, or they'll have some expertise in quantum gravity and particle physics, and so a lot of their research will be sort of overlapping, okay? That's very, very common, and it's actually a very, very good thing. But yeah, fully switching from one expertise to another is less common.
Yeah, well, the other thing I want to say is in most cases you're not, you know, I mean, I think if you talk about fully switching, like I'm going to throw away my old set of skills and learn a totally new set of skills, that only happens rarely. But it's very common for people to take a set of skills that they have, say, from particle physics, and decide, oh, they're interested in, say, quantum information or quantum gravity, and find some problem through collaborations with other people where their expertise is actually useful for this other field. And that gives sort of a foot in the door. I actually think one of the sort of really cool things about being a scientist is that we get to take these sort of, you know, not the 180 degree or 90 degree turns in our career, but the 30 degree shifts really often when we want to, whenever there's an interesting problem that's sort of not quite in our area of expertise. You have the opportunity to branch out a little bit in some other direction. So I know a lot of people that as postdocs went from, say, working on particle physics to thinking about problems in sort of theoretical condensed matter physics. And from string theory to, you know, either of those two. A few people that sort of do things that overlap between quantum information and particle physics. Obviously there's a reason I know mostly people who overlap with particle physics. You know, we've sort of switched back and forth between more theoretical things and more experimental things, which I'd say is a comparably large switch to changing fields. So on the sort of big picture scale, I think Philip's right that sort of if early in grad school you figure out what kinds of problems you're interested in and work on cultivating the expertise for that, that's a good strategy. And plan on sort of roughly following, building on that for the next decade of your professional work or more. But in the process of building on that, one can sort of swing a little bit towards other directions as they seem relevant, exciting, and something that you can apply what you've already learned to.
So just kind of, I want to get back to what you kind of talked about a little bit earlier with the whole idea of like knowing your basics. And I kind of want to ask, like, when is too late for that? Like, if you figure out comparably late, like, what you want to be doing or, and, like, consequently what basics are required, like, when you sort of need to have that down, like, going into, like, end of high school, going into undergrad, like, end of undergrad, like, when is too late to sort of learn that basic knowledge almost, if that makes any sense?
Okay, well, it's never too late. But I know, I mean, that's probably the answer you, well, that... I'm serious, though. It's actually never too late. The thing to focus on, though, I mean, grad school is a ways away. Okay, so, you know, we've been talking a lot about graduate school, and this might as well, I mean, this is a half decade away for most of you, okay? And so right now, you've got like a half decade at over any period of which you could start learning basics. So that's why I say it's just never too late for you at this point. You should just not that should not even be even a remote thought that's coming into your mind at this point. What I said sort of earlier about making sure you learn kind of, you know, learn mathematics, learn basic sciences across all the subjects, learn the humanities really well. I mean, just educate yourself and focus on that. Learn to think, learn to work hard, cultivate being creative. I mean, these are things that will form the basics for doing research later on. Okay, if you just sit down and you sort of very narrowly focus on a particular subject now, that might give you an edge over some, you know, by, you know, compared to a few people, maybe very early on in your graduate school phase, but that'll be washed out very quickly, okay? So it's never too late, just focus on the basics now, but you could start 2 years from now in a totally different area and it really wouldn't make much difference.
I'm the only girl in my mechanics class, and I keep on telling the guys I'm the same as them, and they keep on telling me, girls are not as good in maths. I mean, it's kind of, you have extra pressure for everything you do, at least in a high school level. What's it in the real world?
I think, well, let's see, there's other words unspeakable on recording that I can use for the guys in your physics class. I think it obviously varies from place to place. On the whole, I think people are supportive and sort of the people you interact with on a day-to-day, at least the people I've interacted with on a day-to-day level. And I think I've been lucky, but not unusually lucky to have sort of, you know, enlightened, generally good people as my mostly male collaborators and colleagues. People that you work with on a day-to-day basis are often very supportive, and my experience is when you're collaborating with people, they don't care about your gender or your race or what you look like. They care about how well you can do the work, right? They're depending on you, you're depending on them, and it is a good team effort of the best sort that it should be. Now, I think there's a social aspect and there's a career aspect that are not so rosy, right? So, I mean, plenty of studies have shown, and they don't lie, that there's sort of even unintentional discrimination at the level of hiring. Now, a lot of places try to be more aware of that and try to sort of catch themselves doing that. Again, most of the field, by and large, is very well intentioned these days and is concerned about the fact that their hiring policies might unwittingly be weeding out really talented females. So most people want to make sure that you know that women in physics have equal opportunities. There's this, so I mentioned also a social aspect. I mean, you go to conferences, it's still not uncommon. Well, it's now pretty uncommon for me to go to a conference and be the only woman in the room if it's a reasonable sized conference. But there might be three or four of us in a room of 30. I remember once I went to an astrophysics conference, and astrophysics has a slightly better ratio. And I was really sort of surprised and delighted to see how many women were in the room. It just looked like a sea of female heads. And then I counted them. And it was only 20%. But that was still so much higher than what I've become used to. that it sort of, you know, that it seemed like a lot at the time. So that aspect is different. I think it is tougher. Sometimes some places there are sort of close-knit male, you know, sort of male-bonded groups of physicists, and you have to figure out how are you gonna interface with that? Are you just going to ignore the social component? Are you gonna be one of the guys? You've got to figure it out on a case-by-case basis and try to get to places or groups of people where that's less of an issue if it's not working out so well. But increasingly, there are more women in physics, and I hear a lot fewer of the sort of the really hideous discrimination stories from younger people of my generation than I've heard from people of older generations. I think the culture is getting a lot better. In a field like particle physics, it's still, hyper competitive and there's a sort of very hyper assertive tone of conversations and of normal interactions that I think for a lot of women can be sort of shocking at first, but overall, I think the field is becoming more welcoming. Certainly, my advisor and people that I've worked with closely have all been, I think, very actively attuned to even these sort of social difficulties that young women physicists can have, and sort of help bring you into the field to deal with them. I don't know, does that answer your question?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, you were saying how it's best for graduate school to go to one of the prestigious high schools like Harvard. I was wondering if there's any universities in Canada that you know that are thought of to be as prestigious as those.
This really depends on the detailed field, and it'll be, by the way, it'll probably be different. The answers we give now, like a lot of it depends on just the individual faculty, how prestigious individual faculty members are, and that'll change. By the time you're in grad school, the list will be different than it is right now. I mean, some places like Harvard, they sort of don't have to work for their place on the list because they've been there for 300 years. But I mean, there are certainly, I know PI graduate students that have gone on to do pretty well at the postdoc level, and certainly PI postdocs that have done very well at the faculty level. I know a fair number of people from McGill, but again, it's useless for me to give you these names because and this is in particle physics. If you go into any other aspect of physics, let alone biology or chemistry, I have no idea what the places are. So I'm listing these as examples to show that no, it's not US centralized by any means. That's just where I come from. But it is a long way away. I should also stress that.
Yeah, this is actually very difficult to answer because it depends very specifically on what it is you're doing. Like what branch of physics, whether it's particle physics or a certain type of particle physics or astrophysics or cosmology, and even within those subjects, it depends on sort of what area of expertise you have. And there's plenty of excellent graduate schools in Canada that people have gone through and have gone on to do very well. Okay, so there's no like universal answer. I'm most familiar with the US system because I kind of went through there. But I know plenty of people who came from Canadian graduate schools.
Okay.
I'm just curious. Did you choose by the name of the school or by the advisor?
Yeah, I totally chose by advisor.
Yeah, because that's
a
big part of it.
We
right?
both did, and that was actually yeah what I was about to say because like we're not giving very constructive suggestions here. We're like we don't know, but once you know sort of what kind of fields you're interested in, ask you know if there's one or two people you know in that field at your university. Ask them, sort of, who are some of the people that are doing really interesting work in this field? Where are they? And, you know, maybe try to look at a few of their papers. You know, apply to those schools. If you get in, try to visit, talk to them, make sure that you can stand them, and that you think, oh, this is a person that I could get along with. And then, you know, if you go to a place where there's sort of one advisor that you think is doing interesting, you know, that's doing sort of leading work in a field that you're interested in, then, you know, that's a good place to be.
So a lot of you will have, I think most undergraduate universities partner up students with a faculty advisor of one form or another, especially in your senior year. That's very common. It was true for me as well. And so when you, if you're interested in going undergraduate school, and you're trying to figure out where to apply and where to think about going, you'll be talking with your undergraduate mentors. And when you sit down with your undergraduate mentors and you talk about where to go, they won't ask what the name of the school is. They'll be talking about people, okay? And they'll be saying, oh, well, so-and-so does such-and-such here, so-and-so does such-and-such there, you know, and they'll ask, did you talk to them on in your visit or, you know, have you sent them an email? Things like, I mean, that will be the way that it's sort of, the thinking is organized. It'll be around people, less about names. But of course there's a correlation, okay? I mean, a lot of the very good people are at excellent places that are difficult to get into, but that's the way it'll be approached. And you'll usually do this jointly with your faculty mentors in your undergraduate programs.
As a physicist, how much time do you have for like other subjects? For example, if I really want to like do history on the side, so would that be possible?
As like a double major in university?
Yeah, double major, but then as a career, like just do a little bit of work on the side?
I think that is really hard. Now I know people who have serious hobbies, okay? Like, you know, they play at a sort of not an instrument, not at a professional level, but at a high level, right? And are sort of, or actively involved in a club, that sort of thing. Now, I mean, there are a few physicists who have done very good work in physics, and then sort of later in their career get really interested in history of physics. If history of physics is the niche you're interested in, you might be able to manage that at some point. But the other thing is, I mean, if you're a professional historian, right, you need to be doing field work, you need to be absorbed in that for, you know, more than 40 hours a week while you're doing it, right? And if you're a professional physicist, the same thing. So you can't do it like, oh, today I'm going to do physics in the afternoon and, you know, history of you know, Spanish colonization of the New World in the afternoon. If you keep an avid interest in it, and you know, and read, that's fine. But doing sort of, you know, high level. The other thing is, I mean, in a research field like physics, I think unless you're really trying to do it at a really high level, on some level, it's not that worth doing, right? If you're, and I don't mean in terms of prestige. I mean in terms of if you're doing things that are really original, that are really creative, that are actually changing how people think about the subject, then you're doing something that at least by some measures is a worthwhile way to spend your life. If you're not, you know, but it's a bit of a go big or go home thing. If you're not going to at least try to work at that level, you know, you might as well do something that's more that's where a smaller amount of effort is guaranteed to be productive. So I'm not trying to put down hobbies or interdisciplinary thinking, but I think certainly at the undergraduate level, pursuing two areas and then deciding which one of these am I more passionate about, do I want to go into grad school in, or maybe I don't want to go into grad school at all and want to find another arena where I can sort of use both of these interests, is totally legitimate. And I know quite a few people who had not just the sort of physics and math double major, which is like, you know, that's sort of two sides of the same coin, not two different interests. But, you know, I knew some people that did physics and linguistics, or actually a guy that did physics and history and then went on to, now he's a professor of linguistics. So it's normal to have diverse interests at that stage, but I think at the level of grad school, at least in the sciences, you really have to sort of pick one thing to pursue, you know, full-time plus, and then other things become part-time minus.
Well, how much freedom do you have to choose, like, individual research projects? Like, is it, do you choose completely freely?
At what stage, do you want to know at a particular stage of your career?
Well, like, at your stage,
oh. At my stage, it's basically complete freedom, right? It can be almost too much freedom. So normally, and I should hand the microphone over to you at some point. Do you want to answer this? So as a grad student, it's usually your advisor's job to guide you towards interesting projects. And then gradually people start sort of, you know, getting out of control and thinking of their own ideas and asking their advisor, isn't this interesting? And you know, the advisor will help them sort of develop that. But it's really, first of all, you should be working on projects that your advisor knows something about. Otherwise, they're not going to be much help to you in maturing from early grad student to professional level researcher. And they help you find projects that are interesting, that are at an appropriate level, and that are still contributing something both to the field and to your education. And then, depending on the precise field, the transition from sort of guided research to basically being on your own to choose whatever you want happens sometime either early in the postdoc process or in a few areas. I think that's even expected. It's very much expected of you by late in graduate school. In some areas, it's not expected of you until after you get sort of tenure track position. So that really varies, but certainly at the level of, you know, at our level, it's basically wide open. I mean, if I wanted to spend all my time doing systems biology, I would have the freedom to. I might have a hard time getting tenure because I probably can't contribute very much to systems biology. I know nothing about it, but I would have the freedom to.
Was it hard for you to narrow down into your fields?
For me, not really. I mean, what do you mean by that? That could mean several things, actually.
Well, you say you have a certain expertise, but there's still wiggle room, so it's not really like you have to go into something and there's no going back. Like, you still have some time to figure that out, right? Like, when you hit grad school?
Yeah, when you get into grad school, you still have time to actually... I mean, usually when you get into grad school, you're being accepted by a department, like a physics department or a chemistry department. Some programs are even more specific, where you're actually accepted and supported by a particular advisor. And in those cases, it's a little harder to change. But in the cases where it's the department that's accepting you, you have a lot of flexibility. And in fact, even some graduate programs have a system where they'll cycle graduate students around to different advisors in different subject areas. And that's really great. Because then you can actually spend some time doing a little bit of research in, you know, astrophysics, in cosmology, in, you know, something more theoretical. I mean, so you'll usually have plenty of time.
You touched before and earlier, I think. So what do you do when you get stuck in a problem, like if you don't see any progress?
We get stuck
all the time. We get stuck all the time.
Yeah.
It's not that we don't have experience to draw.
So first of all, if you're okay. Just an aside, If by the time you're doing independent research, if you're never stuck, you're probably not challenging yourself enough. Just I'll just make that remark now. Unless you're just completely outrageously brilliant. But nobody's that brilliant. Okay.
They should still be doing harder problems. They're appropriate,
okay.
So that they get stuck some of the time.
So part of it is that when you get stuck on a particular version of the problem you're working on, one of the things that both of us try is to back up and simplify the problem we're working on, find a simpler analog of it, and just weed out all the things that we can't understand and try to sort of break it down into constituent pieces. There's a certain talent to that that you develop over time. That's the usual approach. Sometimes we'll get stuck in a way where we're just not going to surmount it, at which point, after a while, you give up and you just move on to another problem. But usually it's just a sort of process of kind of breaking it down into simpler and simpler toy versions of the problem until you find the most complicated, realistic toy that you actually can solve. That's what you actually spend most of your time on. At least that's what I spend a good fraction of time on.
Yeah, and then sometimes it's just a matter of, well, I'm stuck. I don't know if this calculation is actually going to get anywhere, if I can finish it, but I better do something. So you start it, and then in the process, that helps you get a sense of what are the moving parts, why am I stuck? But if you can pinpoint why you're stuck, then that's a good first step to, like really precisely, that's a good first step to getting past it. Obviously, as a graduate student, when you're stuck, I think it's a good idea to sort of think along these lines, but also talk to your advisor about your stuckness. A lot of times, when you're stuck early on, it's because you just, you know, there's something that you shouldn't have to reinvent. You should be able to look it up in some paper, but you don't know how to find that paper. And your advisor can just say, oh yeah, look at that. And a lot of times it's something more than that. But again, your advisor can help you sort of learn the techniques for getting through it. But getting stuck doesn't stop at grad school. And at some point you have no one to turn to and you just have to, you know, you just have to sort of plug through it on your own.
There's another thing. So physics generally across a lot of the fields is a very sociable subject. People spend tons of time talking to one another. And I think that goes against the stereotype that a lot of people outside of physics have. But if I could, there's many reasons for this, but one of them touches on this stuckness question. It is amazing how much clearer your thinking is when you are forced to talk about it out loud in words. It's total night and day. It is amazing the total gibberish you can convince yourself of on paper. Just total nonsense. And you can be 100% convinced and just like, oh yes, I've got it. But then when you talk it out loud, you're like, I'm crazy. What the heck was I thinking? Okay? There's a very different thought process. Well, yeah, occasionally. But there is a group dynamic thing that you have to be careful about where everybody just nods their head. But anyway, that's a separate issue. You know, so that's one way to deal with being stuck, is you go talk to your colleagues. And just like, oftentimes, I don't know, the two of us do this a fair amount. We'll walk into each other's office and be like, let me just show you something on the board. I'll write like two lines, I'll be like, okay, never mind. You know, and you just go back. I mean, anyway, so that's another way we deal with it.
I don't know if this applies to either of you, but I find even in things that I absolutely love doing, there's always like little specific aspects that I just dread. Is there anything like that in your job where you know you have to do something, and small thing, but you really don't want to do it?
Email? So, you know, there is a lot of like, keeping up email exchanges fast enough to get something out of them sometimes with just collaborators, just people you're corresponding with. I don't really like refereeing papers or dealing with the referee reports on my papers when it comes to actually publishing in journals, but it's important, so you do it. Both sides are important and usually productive. It's just not a great amount of fun. Sometimes I really enjoy writing papers, sometimes I really dislike it, and trying to sort of polish the math in papers. Like checking signs on and making sure that I have all the conventions the same on page 1 and page 5, which doesn't matter to me because I figured out both conventions, but it matters to somebody who's trying to read the paper for the first time. there's a lot of little things that I dread.
Yeah, I know this is being recorded. I apologize to everybody for not replying to my email. This is the thing I don't like doing. So.
What are some other emerging branches of theoretical physics that you see, I guess, in the near future? Besides, like, particle physics, like, it's really exciting right now. What are other emerging branches?
Well, the first thing so both of us have this is true of a lot of different subfields. First of all, the divisions in some cases artificial. Particle physicists are a bit arrogant. All of physics is our, like, domain, okay? Just everything. It's the world. And to some extent, it's even true. So, yeah, so then like, you know, we're talking about everything's
cosmology.
Origin of the universe. Of course that's cosmology, you know. So it's, anyway, but more seriously, I mean, there's a lot going on right now that's interesting. So there's been a number of fantastic advances, a lot of which are being pioneered here in quantum field theory, specifically by people who work in what's known as the, you know, string and quantum field theory group. We don't really have groups, but there's tremendous amount of progress being made on quantum field theories that are strongly coupled. This has been a notoriously hard problem in the past. There's been a tremendous amount of progress understanding quantum entanglement and correlations in interacting relatively complex quantum systems. The condensed matter group has made very interesting progress in contributions there. So condensed matter is interesting. Particle physics, of course, is trying to confront dark matter and other things like that. So I don't think any of, I don't know, I mean, one way to, I could go on, but I actually find all of the subjects that are worked on in this building quite interesting. It almost gets, there's a certain, I won't call it aggravation, but like, you know, we have a lot of seminars, we have a lot of talks, we have a lot of conferences. A lot of the times you want to go to a lot of these things, and you can actually. If you go to all of them, of course, and you really try to dig in, you'll spend half or two-thirds of your time just doing that. So it gets very difficult. You have to kind of pick and choose what to spend your time learning about. But I'm not sure if that's sort of the answer you're looking for. We could talk more about specific subjects if you want. But, or Natalia, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think, I mean, you mentioned a few examples, but I think it's true that in general, when, you know, at least where I am right now with my research, there's very much a strong tendency to get sort of focused. If anything, maybe a little too focused. Like, when I'm thinking about physics, I want to be thinking about the physics I'm working on, not reading the sort of broader science journals to think about what else is going on. Or, I mean, so there's mainly talking to people in the building about what they're doing, learning sort of what's, you know, learning roughly what's going on, going to colloquia. I think there does seem to be a lot of progress these days in an area of condensed matter, which is also very, it's no coincidence, this is also something done at PI, that's part of why I know about it, on sort of quantum materials. So basically understanding materials or surfaces of materials, where there's very interesting quantum mechanical effects that happen even on larger distances, where in order to describe this, you know, sort of certain kinds of metal, basically, you have to consider quantum effects. Like, you can think of them as having quantum effects that connect from one edge to another. So I think that has potentially some interesting applications that haven't really been explored yet. It's also true that there's just the sort of symmetries of quantum physics allow a lot wilder phenomena in two spatial dimensions on a surface than they do in space. So that's part of why there's all kinds of wild and really interesting things that people studying basically the boundaries of one surface to another can sort of play with.
Can I just rephrase Jason's question a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah.
If you were back at your PhD level, and you've got to choose a new pathway or a new question that you would pursue rather than particle physics, is there a field that you would right now go, oh, I would love to be just stepping out into condensed matter? Or is there something out there that kind of really intrigues you right now, or a question that really is intriguing you outside your field?
For me, I think the questions that intrigue me outside of that are close enough that I've been able to sort of work them in and say, oh yeah, that's part of the particle physics I work in. but that's just me.
I mean, look, to be honest with you, if I had to do it all over again, it wouldn't be physics per se. This is, may sound a little off the wall, but to me, probably the most important question I want to answer that I think might even be answerable in our lifetime is there life elsewhere in the universe? To be honest with you, that's what I would probably do if I were totally switching. Wouldn't be physics even.
So going into theoretical physics, if like what are the job opportunities? Because I know places like this, and then like teaching, those are the only sort of job things I know of. But what else is there? And that is common.
Well, so there's so in addition to so I guess there many people do go into either sort of high school or very teaching heavy. University teaching positions. There's also a lot of very research-heavy university positions as well, where you do teach some courses, but your main responsibilities are research. I mean, it's rough. Some fraction is teaching, some fraction is research and training graduate students, which is basically more research, but guiding other people in research as well. There's labs that are also research facilities, in a way kind of like PI, but with both an experimental and a theoretical component. This is outside of, so then all of those I'd sort of broadly put into academia, even though there's this huge spectrum of what fraction of your time you spend doing research versus teaching. Those are sort of the two main components in academia. Outside of that, so I know some people that have gone into sort of other industries after graduate school that maybe aren't, I mean, I think graduate school to some extent really trains people for, most specifically for academia, but a lot of people go out and do either sort of high-tech computer stuff, financial industry stuff. I know one person, he was an experimentalist who's doing like alternative energy stuff. Afterwards, people can go into any kind of policy that involves a lot of science aspects. It's also, I think, these disciplines often seek out people with a sort of science PhD. So it gets, if you decide that research/teaching isn't for you, and you decide that, partway through grad school or at the end of grad school, or later, those are all definitely sort of areas that I think you can transition into from academic research. Are there others that
there's other
main ones. There's obviously others, but those are, I think, the three sort of main ones.
Anybody? I want to make sure we get people who haven't asked questions yet. Have you?
No.
Good. Yeah.
Okay, I heard from a number of people that the height of a physicist's creativity is like his or her early 20s, and they say like if you are going to make a breakthrough in physics, you have to do it before you hit 30. So is it true, or like what do you think about it?
Yeah, learn a little bit about, so just take a look at some of the history of science. First of all, you should, how old was Newton when he did his?
23.
That's for some of the calculus though.
Like,
that's not gravity.
But I know he like invented calculus and like a lot of stuff like before he turned 36.
Yeah, that's math. Math is easy.
And a lot of the stuff that went into Newton's calculus, that's when he started reading the books that gave him the idea of calculus.
Yeah, a lot of his early calculus was.
Right. Had he not read those books until he was 35, he would have invented calculus when he was 35. No problem. It was all the rage back then before Newton to divide up the different shapes in clever ways and use infinite series to get the area of the shape. And that was basically the problem that got him on the path to calculus.
So both of us have sort of history of science a little bit as a hobby, and this is a question that we've wondered about ourselves. So first of all, it's not uniformly true. Okay, lots of significant breakthroughs. Einstein's early work was when he was younger, but a lot of GR was sort of towards his later 20s, okay? So that even that's not quite true. Say again? Sorry, I just which is what I thought I heard somebody had a question. But that's one example. So there's the other, Feynman was productive all the way into his later years. So was Dirac, actually.
I think there was actually a paper just brought out a couple of years ago where they actually did sort of do an analysis of that. And they said it was actually pushing up into the 40s that you have a peak. That's a bit of a myth that the physics has done in the 20s.
Well, so I haven't seen this paper, but what we started noticing when we started looking at what individual people were doing beyond just the cherry-picked works that you hear about, like the special theory of relativity or the Dirac equation, you know, which were done early in their careers. Okay, if you look more broadly at what these people did that we actually use and made impact, it spread out over a much longer period of time. So that was one of the first things we noticed. But what did start to happen was that it did slow down a little bit. But then if you looked at what people were doing with their lives, there were really practical reasons why they did most of their work when they were young. Okay, they were kind of unburdened by anything at some level, right? They were really doing research all the time. And then life starts to happen. You know, they want to have a family. They got to deal with administrative duties with their job. You know, I mean, important things, right?
They get enlisted in a war effort.
They get enlisted in a war effort. I mean, that's a big deal for many of these physicists for the First and the Second World War. Okay.
Yeah, displaced by a war.
Or killed in the war. I mean, anyway, this is a very, very big, you know, people talk about this a lot. But I haven't seen this paper, but just anecdotally, from what I've read, I wouldn't agree with it anyway. But it is true that productivity, at least anecdotally, seems to be higher. Like, it's more intense when people are younger. But that's also pretty easy to understand, just at the level of how what kind of responsibilities people are dealing with.
Okay.
Yeah.
In your work developing and sometimes even testing your theories through experiments, how much contact do you have with like the future applications that could come from your research, or do you just leave that to like, engineers and just focus on ideas?
So far, the work kind of work that I've done, and this is I think more quite specific to particle physics actually, is right now just doesn't have much in the way of sort of short term applications, by which I mean within my lifetime. If there's a, I think it would be better to ask somebody that, say, works in quantum information about this kind of thing. Like, I know some of our colleagues here have patents that are theorists, right? So that's a pretty close degree of engagement with the eventual applications of work. But that's just not a question that I can really speak to, because my work does not yet have any known applications.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering, in your work, how much contact do you have with actual applications that the public might use, like technologies or things like that? Or do you just focus more on the theories and the ideas?
The work that we're doing with high-intensity experiments, looking for dark matter-related things, a lot of the technologies used for that are also used in other areas, like medicine and other sorts of applications where detecting particles is actually important. But we don't directly do that. I mean, that's much more of an experimental effort. In terms of potential applications, I agree with what Natalia said. It's hard to envision right now.
Yeah, by the way, I'll just add, this was something I struggled with early in grad school, was the fact that I was going into a field that, you know, quite possibly would not have any, you know, impact on sort of people's lives within my lifetime. And it really upset me. It made me seriously question, you know, do I want to stay in this field or quit now and do something else? And it was, in the end, a question of whether I valued the intellectual aspect of what I was doing enough to compensate for the lack of applications. And I decided, well, there were two things that allowed me to very happily continue in the field. The first was realizing that if at some point I felt like intellectually it had dried up, I could still quit and do something else, you know, quote unquote, useful with my life later. That was a very liberating realization. And then the other one was just that, you know, I decided that for me personally, being able to sort of understand the, understand how things work and to really ask new kinds of questions about nature was an exciting and deep enough and sort of culturally relevant enough question that I was happy being a sort of, you know, artist of mathematics or whatever you want to call it in the same sense. But that, you know, it's an issue that I struggled with. That's the side that I came out on, was that I loved the intellectual questions enough to spend my time on them. But it is, it is an issue that for the specific field of particle physics that I work in is something one has to decide on. I think if you survey around the building, there are a lot of people who do work on theoretical physics. It's still much closer to application. And I don't know in each person's case whether that's part of the reason they chose that field or not. But it can be a factor.
Yeah, at some level, this is a big team effort, right? I mean, so a lot of the mathematicians, for example, working in their respective subject areas, certainly if they were to ask, oh, is this going to have applications, they would just get depressed, okay? It's hard to, no, I mean, they would. And then some significant period of time, in some cases not so long, somebody else has a use for what they're doing. And then that application has a tremendous impact in the world. These things are just enormously hard to predict. We both in the past, though, have struggled with this, because going into sort of basic physics, just forget about thinking directly about applications. It's not realistic. But it is just a fact of history that as we've understood the world, even really pretty far out aspects of understanding the world have crept into daily life in a very, very dramatic way, and are continuing to. There's another aspect of this which sort of tilted the scale, at least when I was kind of struggling with this, which is just that at some level, you know, on the sort of scale of human history, we learn about the sort of way that nature works precisely once, right? You figure out how things work and it is done. That's it. So we're at this completely fine-tuned point in history where we're still making pretty good progress at that. And so, you know, I go back and forth between kind of wanting to participate in the sort of one-time kind of get in at the ground level, make a huge impact in the world in a very real, visceral way. But then I get pulled back because I want to be part of the process of, you know, figuring out what the universe is made out of. And just, that's going to be done once, okay? And then we're done, and then we move on. So that sort of keeps pulling me back, but it's a continual struggle.
What type of opportunities should you look for, like specifically while you're working on your undergrad degree? I know we talked a bit, like in high school, just kind of like reading and developing your basis. Should you just continue doing that during your undergrad, or are there like specific opportunities?
So this depends also probably on where you are, to some extent. But some general guidelines. Okay, so in addition to sort of learning the basics, I think later in undergraduate, in your undergraduate career, a lot of schools have research opportunity programs. I mean, they go by different names. I mean, certainly
yeah.
Our program did. And there's also
there's
a lot of national ones. But this is why I was going to say that sort of depends on where you are. I mean, I don't know. I think Canada has national ones as well, for sure. The U.S. has them. I think plenty of other countries do. Participating in those programs is usually a very good idea. It gives you a flavor early on for what research might be like. And it also gives you some hands-on experience. Do try to do that if you can.
Help you figure out what you don't like doing as well.
There are opportunities for undergrads to come to Perimeter as interns as well. Things like that. Like you look around and there are places. But you referred to earlier as undergraduate, to kind of get people's attention for graduate school, right? You kind of talked about when you're an undergraduate, you want to do things to raise your profile. How do you do that? What are the things you do?
Participating in those programs is one example. My knowledge is a little dated on this, though. I'm not aware of the umbrella of programs out there now. I think it's...
Right, but I mean, there are these, so if, for example, if you do a summer research internship or one of these research programs at another university, usually the person you work with can write you a reference letter. And they'll say, you know, this person took a research project that was pretty advanced for them, which, let's face it, as undergrads, most of the projects you get are going to be pretty advanced for you, and manage to tackle it in the following sort of impressive ways and make reasonable progress. In some cases, people get a paper out of it. In some cases, they don't. I don't think at the... When I've been on grad school admissions, I don't really care whether a paper came out. If somebody was able to really sort of to tackle a problem and, you know, and find their way around it, that and their advisor says they worked hard, they gave it, you know, they gave it their all, they had some you know, creativity and resourcefulness in the process, that's very impressive. At the same time, you know, the other thing is just taking the sort of, you know, taking your advanced classes, doing well in them, ask questions. So I know in some cases, I didn't do this, but some people do sort of reading projects with some of the faculty at their university. They sort of read about some special topic beyond the usual undergraduate curriculum, and, you know, read through some papers, discuss it sort of one-on-one. That's another good opportunity to learn about something and to sort of show who you are to faculty.
But I want to be careful not to paint too narrow of a picture here, because it's not so much that you participated in some national program or some specific university program where you do a research project. That's not sort of the... Okay, so at a very practical level, so if people are looking at your applications for graduate school, if there is a letter, for example, from some supervisor who says, this person really took ownership over a problem and really dove into it, and maybe they got stuck, maybe it led to a paper, that part actually matters a lot less. It's just they really took ownership, they really dug into it, and they drove it along to some extent, or they, you know, tried to think about it on their own. They were good at getting help when they needed it. You know, just sort of that kind of thing. Pride in their work, showing initiative, and that could be working with a particular professor, not in an official program. It could be working with, you know, in an official program with a supervisor. That's the way to think about this. That's actually the way in which you'll get noticed in a manner that's sort of transferable, you know, that you can sort of put on your application. So I'm just speaking in terms of very practical terms. The specifics matter a lot less than you know, an instance of some kind of project where you take pride in it, you show initiative, and somebody notices. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what you basically, like, everybody's grad school application has, like, I think, three letters of reference in it, right? So they could come from people you interacted with in any way, shape, or form. If they all say, you know, so-and-so came to my class, pretty much attended regularly, and was in the top 10% in terms of grade, I hope they do well. Well, you know, that's not really going to stand out. But generally, I mean, I don't actually know how I got into grad school, because I would have imagined that a lot of my references might have looked something like that, if I had to guess what I would have written about me from the perspective of people who asked. But I mean, if you're engaged in the classes, if you're sort of, you know, if you're thinking about things, asking the professors questions, also usually your undergraduate supervisor can write a letter that tells a little bit more about who you are. And by the way, on the research front, it doesn't matter what area the research is in. So I want to just stress that. Like, you shouldn't think, oh, if I want to do particle physics in grad school, I better do a particle physics project as an undergraduate. That's completely unnecessary. And most people that I know who did research as undergraduates, it was in different fields. So, you know, and it's just if you take ownership of a problem and either do something interesting in it, or at least get far enough to get stuck in a sort of interesting way. But getting away from the whole admissions thing for a while, what do you get out of it, right? What you get out of it is if you're really thinking carefully about the physics that you're learning in your classes, the math that you're learning in your classes, you understand it better. And you start sort of asking questions about why it works the way it does. That's the level you want to be at intellectually. If you're doing some research projects, you're figuring out how to deal with the getting stuck that's part of that, how to go out and really calculate things that aren't just problems out of a textbook, but that are several steps harder than that, how to sort of grapple with that scale of problem. And you're figuring out what kinds of things you're good at, what kinds of things you're bad at, and what kinds of things you like and don't like. And all of that also So if you just focus on that, focus on doing things that are good for your own education, the letters come out of it.
So I want to make sure we have people who have not asked questions yet. Did you ask? Okay.
Just wondering, are a lot of like theoretical physicists kind of like you and able to work with the like experimental side of things as well, or is it mostly just like you're either one or the other?
Most people are either one or the other. If you're willing to, if I don't know how to put this, you can do a bit of both. It has its own challenges. You have to be a little bit careful about how you divide your time and about sort of what problems you choose to work on, but you can certainly do both in particle physics. That's absolutely a possibility.
Yeah. If you're willing to do the thing where you run off the, like the cartoon characters, you run off the cliff and then you quickly turn around and you
back.
Land back there
okay.
on the solid ground, if you're willing to do that.
That is an awesome analogy, by the way.
Then,
yeah.
then you can totally, you know, dip into the.
Yeah. Gets a little scary at times.
I guess this is more like further down the road, but like how important is the social aspect of physics as a theoretical physicist? For example, like do you need to be able to give like free talks to like the general public or like to fellow colleagues, like in order to like move yourself up to like a certain position or like to gain recognition or something?
It's like any other field. In order for people to figure out who you are, you need to be doing quality work, and then you need to know how to talk about it. So you certainly have to know how to talk to groups of people. So some people are natural public speakers, and they just, you know, they just give great talks all the time. Other people have to really work at it. I certainly have to work at it. I still get nervous every time I give a talk. Like it just hasn't changed. I get as nervous now as I used to get when I was even an undergrad. It just hasn't. It's totally the same. But you work at it, and that's very important because if people can't understand your articulation of your work, then you're going to have that's going to be a problem. So that part is very important, but it's not unique to physics. That's true of any subject.
And you get a lot of practice in it as well.
We're gonna break for lunch in a second. Do you guys have any last things you want to say to them? And they're gonna join us for lunch, correct? So you guys can ask more questions over lunch and stuff. Do you have any last things you want to, any gems of wisdom or insight about life as a physicist?
Just do your best, seriously, just do your best.